If any one word to me sums up Christmas, it's not giving, it's anticipation. Seems to me to be what it's all about. My wife has a little chalkboard. It's only about maybe 6 inches square, and at the bottom it has the words permanently painted on it, days till Christmas. And it's got a blank field above that. We'll be going out of town on Tuesday night and not returning until sometime Friday night, the 26th. But when we get back, if it's before midnight, she'll go down to that little chalkboard and write on there 366 days till Christmas. And that's because next year's a leap year. And anticipation, we talked a little bit about that this morning, the anticipation of the Old Testament saints. Something that I seem to make mention of every year because it's so obvious to me. Again, 2,000 years they waited as Israelites for their Messiah, and 4,000 years the human race waited for the coming of the promised seed of the woman. Children of all ages, of course, anticipate Christmas. I've been anticipating preaching this text. I've been anxious to get here, but I didn't want to rush through what came before, and I managed to have to do a little bit of that. I'd like to spend a little more time on Mary's Magnificat, but it just didn't allow any more time. But no matter how much you and I are looking forward to the holiday, it can't compare to the eagerness with which the faithful Israelites were awaiting this event. And here it is. It's now occurred. Here's the birth. Every birth of every human child is a marvelous event. It brings into the world a soul that is never going to cease to exist. But this birth is the birth of a being who has always existed. The birth of a being who brought all things into existence. This is the birth of the pre-incarnate, pre-existent, and eternal Son of God as a member of the human race. That's a miracle, folks, and a marvel that you and I will probably never fully appreciate. And Paul calls it the mystery of godliness. In 1 Timothy 3:16, he says, "And without controversy, great was the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh," and so forth. I want to take a minute and look first of all at the world which he entered. Chapter 2, verse 1 through 3, "And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria, and all went to be taxed, every one, into his own city." We have the times and the place to look at. The times will come first. To me, the wisdom of God comes through so obviously in this little statement here. The Jews were under the dominion and taxation of a foreign power. Strangers ruled over them. What government they seemed to have of their own was really only a puppet established by Rome. And this is due time. The entire civilized world was now governed, ruled, dictated, and taxed by a single master. All the priests and all the princes of the heathen world had been overthrown but one, and there was one authority over all, and it was Rome. Sumer, Akkad, Egypt, Syria, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, with their gods, they'd all come and gone. They'd all had a shot at ruling the world, and all of them managed for a while, but all of them failed in the lingering expectation of kings. Now Rome had come to power. Rome had either ground all other civilizations under her heel or absorbed into herself those portions of their cultures and religions that matched her and suited her and absorbed them into herself. And all that had come before had proven that the world by wisdom knew not God. And Rome could do no better. And so it all lay in heathen, pagan, superstitious darkness. The conquerors, the historians, the poets, the architects, the shipbuilders, the engineers, the philosophers of the ancient world had accomplished great things, but they had failed to lift themselves out of the darkness of idolatry and superstition. It's no accident that this taxing was made, or that Rome was in power at this very time, or that the decree would require Mary and Joseph to journey to Bethlehem at just this precise time. This Caesar Augustus, in verse number 1, his name was Octavian. He's the first of all the Caesars to adopt the title of Augustus. He happened to be the great nephew of Julius, and he was a born fighter. after Julius, Rome had become somewhat effete and divided after Julius was murdered, and became filled with intrigue and rival factions, and barbarians were knocking at the door. The empire was somewhat at risk. But Octavian came to the throne and restored the empire and much more. He catapulted it forward for centuries, made it invincible and unassailable for two centuries after his death. This is the same Caesar Augustus who challenged and overthrew the combined powers of Antony and Cleopatra, and then went on to use his will and his talents to stabilize the empire so thoroughly that it remained intact for centuries despite the numerous weak and dilettante leaders that followed him. His title, Augustus, was given to him by the Roman Senate. Before Octavian, it had never been used of anything other than a god. It means holy or revered. Up to that point, it was reserved for their imagined deities, but in Octavian's day, men began to regard the Caesars as gods. We found inscriptions, not me personally, but men have found inscriptions that referred to Octavian as the savior of the whole world. And when he died, it's recorded that men comforted themselves, encouraged one another by reflecting on the idea that if Augustus was a god, and gods don't die, then Augustus was not truly dead. At the helm of the world, then, you have a man who was regarded as a god, sent to rule and to save the world in men's imaginations. And by the way, the stage was set for a contest now that would rage for at least three centuries between Caesar and Christ as to who really was God incarnate and the Savior of the world. Octavian was the first Caesar, but not the first ruler to be regarded as a god, nor was he the last, and nor have we seen the last of his kind. There's an even more sinister one yet on the horizon. But to move ahead, this restless and relentless man was in the process of restoring and building up the glory of Rome, and in order to do that, it required revenue. And to gather up all that revenue, even a little insignificant couple in a little insignificant village all the way at the opposite end of the Mediterranean Sea wasn't going to be overlooked in the pursuit of government funds. But you know, in the end, students of history may know something about Octavian. Those who are interested in the Roman Empire or in the ancient world may be familiar with the name of Octavian and some of his accomplishments, the names of his affiliates, but there's three names that stand out much more vividly in the minds of almost every human being today than Octavian, and that's Mary, and Joseph, and the baby Jesus. They're much better known than Octavian, and most people who know about Octavian today, frankly, they wouldn't know what they do know about him if it wasn't because of the fact that knowing about Octavian sheds a little bit more light on the story of Christmas. This birth was an invasion. God in human flesh invading the world, a military insertion, if you will, of one super invincible super soldier who would conquer and overthrow completely the enemy. And let me ask you, who's insignificant now? The Creator had woven for himself a robe of virgin flesh, and the contest would begin between Creator and Caesar, a man who would become God and the true God who became man. And we know the answer. We know who prevailed. You know, we ought never forget that the times and the circumstances are in God's hand. He knows the best time to send help to the church. He knows the best time to send light to the world. He's not confused. He's not off schedule. He's not been put out of business. He's absolutely in control. And we can never, we ought never be anxious about the way things are going on around us. It's easy to become anxious and fret, but we shouldn't. We don't know best, but he does. Martin Luther once had a close friend by the name of Philip Melanchthon. Melanchthon tended to be something of an anxious and nervous man. Luther's advice to him was, "Cease, Philip, to try and govern the world." There's some things over which you have no control, and since you can't change them, the best thing to do is simply yield to the sovereign control and will of God in those matters. You say, well, it was awful that Octavian was Caesar. But it was in the plan of God. It was awful that Octavian decreed that all the world be taxed, but it was in the plan of God. It was awful that Mary and Joseph had to travel when she was great with child from Nazareth to Bethlehem, but it was in the plan of God. And see, the reason why we get upset, and the reason why we get ulcers, and the reason why we get out of fellowship with God is because we question His choosing. Secondly, you have not just the times, but the place. The city of Bethlehem was not where his mother lived. But there was a prophecy that had to be fulfilled. It's in Micah 5:2. But thou, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall he come forth unto me that is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been of old from everlasting. God turns the heart of kings just like he can turn the heart of voters. And it was by God's direction that Augustus would choose at this precise time to collect a tax. It was all divinely appointed and flawlessly executed. Both Mary and Joseph were of the house and lineage of David, and so that was the place where both of them had to go to pay their taxes, to the city of David. The emperor sat there in his throne, or on his throne in the palace in Rome, imagining himself to be the very personification and embodiment of absolute sovereignty and power. There was no person in the world that wasn't subject to his will, at least in the world that Octavian knew. He fancied himself an irresistible will and an irresistible power over the earth, haughty, thoughtless of any rival, never thinking or imagining that he and the empire that he controlled were nothing more than instruments in the hand of the God of Israel. All of his actions, while he imagined they came out of his own mind, were nothing more than part of a plan devised by a God he'd only heard of, by the God over a small group of his subjects over in Palestine. It was all part of a plan designed to bring humanity to the true King of Kings and the true Lord of Lords. Caesar sits on his throne and decrees the events that lay the foundation of a kingdom before which Rome would crumble and all the rulers of the world would one day bow. Therefore, it ought to cheer the heart of every believer to take comfort in considering that God providentially rules the world. World events are interesting, but they're more than interesting. They're important. I care about what happens in the world. And thank God, as citizens of this nation, we have some participation in selecting our leaders. And we do have a certain amount of limited influence over what our rulers do. And we should pray. And we can vote. And I believe in campaigning. I've run for office. So I believe in the involvement of Christians in the political system. If there's anyone worth getting behind, I believe we ought to support them and endorse them and put bumper stickers on the car and signs in the yard. But when it doesn't go the way we'd like, we ought not be dismayed by what we see. By the eye of faith, we have to remember that God is still in it all and over it all. As foolish as some of them are, as wicked and vile as some of them are, those who reach the positions of rule and government in this world are still nothing more than creatures who are limited in power by those things which God allows and can go no more than a breath, or not even a breath, beyond what God allows them to do. Not only the place that he entered, but look in verse 6 and 7. Well, we didn't read verse 4 and 5, but Joseph also went up from Galilee out of the city of Nazareth into Judea unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary as a espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. It wasn't under his mother's roof, and certainly wasn't in a sanitary hospital that Jesus was born, but in a strange and unfamiliar place. You can be sure it was the right place, the perfect place, the divinely appointed place, the chosen place, the prepared place. It was the exact place that God wanted it to happen. When we imagine events that we're separated from by time, hundreds of years, thousands of years, it's easy to think of the familiar when we try to imagine things we've never seen and make a make a comparison between the two. Or if someone suggests an image to us, we become comfortable with what we've seen in a magazine or in a piece of art, in a work of art or on a movie. And from then on, we think in terms of somebody else's vision of something that occurred. If you imagine that the place where Jesus was born was anything at all like a freshly swept stable at the county fair, you don't really understand what it was like. People in the Middle Ages, perhaps, and I mean perhaps, could have better understood what it was like for Jesus to be born where he was born. They could understand it perhaps better than you and I can, but I'm not sure that they could completely understand it. The conditions that they were living with were so much better than the ones that he experienced. One preacher researched it thoroughly and wrote these words. He said, "In Bethlehem, the accommodations for travelers were primitive. The Eastern Inn was the crudest of arrangements. Typically, it was a series of stalls built on the inside of an enclosure and opening onto a common yard where the animals were kept. All the innkeeper provided was fodder for the animals and a fire to cook on. On that cold day when the expectant parents arrived, nothing at all was available, not even one of those crude stalls. And despite the urgency, no one would make room for them. So it was probably in the common courtyard where the travelers' animals were tethered that Mary gave birth to Jesus, and only Joseph attending her. Joseph probably wept as much as Mary did, seeing her pain, the stinking barnyard, their poverty, people's indifference, the humiliation, the sense of utter helplessness, feeling shame at not being able to provide for young Mary on the night of her travail. All that would make any man either curse or cry. It was wretched, scandalous. There was sweat and pain and blood and cries. Mary reached up to heaven for help, and the earth was cold and hard. The smell of birth mixed with the stench of manure and acrid straw, and it all blended together in a contemptible bouquet. Joseph reached out with calloused and trembling carpenter's hands, but clumsy now with fear, and he grasped the Son of God, slippery with blood. And the little baby waved his limbs helplessly as if falling through space. Joseph's face grimaced as he gasped in the cold, and his cry pierced the night. My mother groaned, my father wept, as into the dangerous world I leapt. Think about the leap that it was. Rising from his exalted splendor in the third heaven, the Son of God poised at the rim of the universe, bade his father and the angels farewell, and dove headlong into outer space. Across the universe he sped at thousands of times the speed of light, past all the other galaxies toward the Milky Way, through its center, lastly passing Arcturus and landing in the womb of a virgin girl in Nazareth. After being the light and dwelling the light and giving light to all creation, he spent the next 9 months in the darkness of Mary's womb until the next light that he would see would be the reflection of the fire in the eyes of a huddle of animals in a filthy barnyard. Mary counts his little fingers and toes. Together, Joseph and Mary clean the baby as best as they can under the glow of the firelight with the little that they had available to do the job. And then Mary takes little strips of cloth and begins to carefully wrap each limb and then his body like a mummy. Swaddling clothes, because he was born to die. He's the Lamb of God. And then he's laid in a feeding trough. What human being, what child born in those days would have had more dismal prospects for the future than this one? Except for the fact that he's the Son of God. Here you see the grace, the condescension of the Lord. As I said not long ago, he could have come to a palace, and he could have lived with great wealth and power and authority, and to have done that would have been condescension and mercy. And that would have caused us to wonder, but to come like this, poor as the poorest of mankind, lowly as he can be. That's love that passeth understanding. But Paul said in Romans 11:33, oh, the rich, unsearchable riches of Christ. Once again, folks, we should be careful this time of year not to despise the poor. There are people who are poor as a result of their own bad choices and prodigal lives. But sometimes people are poor because they're just having a hard time. God looks at the heart of a man and not at his investment portfolio. When I came to Christ, I was poor. I had nothing. It was my own fault, but I had nothing. A little more than 3 years, about 3 years later, I left for Bible college. I had a little bit more than I had when I was saved. I had a little more than that when I graduated from Bible college 4 years later. Now I got so much I don't know what to do with it all sometimes, but my heart isn't better for it, and neither is my real worth. Be careful, because that person that you might look at with contempt and scorn, and you might laugh at and ridicule because they have less than you, you understand, they may be going through that because God has appointed some great thing for them, and they need to suffer in order to learn some lessons that God might use them greatly later. Last thing you want to do is envy the privileged. I watched enough of The Simple Life on Thursday, just enough to be disgusted. I didn't think Paris and Nicole were clever. I didn't think they were funny. I didn't even think they were attractive. But it wasn't them that disgusted me. It was their parents. To be ungrateful, to be covetous, to be scornful of those who have less than yourself is disgraceful. But it's no disgrace to fall on hard times. Someone's poor because of squandering and wastefulness and laziness and weak character. That's something to be ashamed of. If you're the cause, then you have something to be ashamed of yourself. If a parent puts you there, the fault is theirs. We live in a world where there's ways out of it. Some people don't just get out. They struggle right past the middle class and move on to fabulous wealth, and then they raise Paris and Nicole. Jesus willingly took on himself a humble dwelling, a hard bed, simple food, physical labor. And those things should never be despised, or scorned by those who claim to follow him. Wealth has ruined a whole lot more people than poverty ever has. And if the love of money is creeping into your soul, think of the manger in Bethlehem and the home in Nazareth for a while. Get your priorities realigned. I've been celebrating Christmas for 28 years now as a Christian. Every year at this time, it makes me wonder. It was very easy for me to love Christmas as a child of God because I was saved at a Christmas cantata. As I mentioned last Sunday, the very Sunday was my 28th spiritual birthday. Tonight is the anniversary, the 28th anniversary of my baptism. By the way, I was just as saved before it as I was after it. But when I found out there was something that Christians did, I wanted to do it. I was saved in a group of people who enjoyed and happily celebrated the holiday. And I'll tell you the truth, I was willing to give it up. I came very close to giving the holiday up at one point because I felt like that maybe was the right thing to do. But it wasn't hard for me to love it. And I still love it, and I love it more now maybe than ever before. Every year at this time when I think about the incarnation, when it comes time to start preparing Christmas sermons again, it makes me wonder. I'm not the first person to be awestruck by the incarnation or the marvel of virgin birth. Not by a long shot. St. Augustine said of the baby Jesus, unspeakably wise, he is wisely speechless. Sir Lancelot Andrews, who's responsible for most of the language, the verbiage of your Old Testament, your King James Bible, 1608 on Christmas Day, he preached a message, and James I was in attendance. He picked up on Augustine's statement there, and he said that he was the Word without a word. And Lucy Shaw wrote a poem titled Mary's Song, and there she declared, quiet he lies, whose vigor hurled the universe. He sleeps, whose eyelids have never closed before. It's the mystery of godliness. we glibly confess that we believe Jesus Christ to be the God-man. And that confession is absolutely correct. He's nothing less than the God-man. But do you know anything at all about what it is that you're saying when you make that confession? As a real baby in the cradle, Jesus could hold out his hand like any baby would and watch his own tiny fist clench and open again. Watch his fingers move just like any other baby in uncomprehending fascination. But the marvel of that was, as he did so, he wasn't pretending. He lays there in the crib and he's not thinking to himself something like this, "You just think that I'm a pre-articulate baby discovering I have a hand. But actually I'm God, admiring my own brilliant invention. And not only that, but I'm your creator. And while you think I don't know, I understand every word you're saying while you're talking about me looking at my hand." That's not the case. He's not pretending. It wasn't a spoof. It was real. The Word became flesh. The wisdom of God, or the foolishness of God, is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. And there he lies, God manifest in the flesh. He's not pretending. And as he would experience all the natural development of a human child, he walked like a baby before he walked like a boy, before he walked like a man. He talked like a baby before he talked like a child, before he talked like an adult. His thought processes moved from childish to adolescent to adult, just like anybody else. All of it. The child grew and waxed strong in spirit, and the grace of God was upon him. Everything. But the difference is he did it perfectly. And he did it sinlessly. That doesn't mean he was an instant learner. But he who made the universe had to learn carpentry from his stepfather. She brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. And that's why Hebrews declares in chapter 4 and verse number 15, "For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin."